This week in KMA land, severe storm surge triggers tornadoes. Page County supervisors participate in candidates' forum. Allegations over Tabor police aired at a special city council meeting. Montgomery County Board hears Red Oak EMS debate. Shenandoah Public Library celebrates Sunshade Project's completion. And the IEDA head tours Shenandoah. I'm Mike Peterson. Well, all week, National Weather Service officials warned of a severe weather outbreak in KMA land Thursday. Well, those early forecasts developed almost as expected, as a massive line of severe storms rolled through the region, generating heavy rain, hail, and a few tornadoes. Devin Shehak is meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Valley, Nebraska office. Shehak tells KMA News storms began developing with the arrival of a cold front west of the Omaha Council Bluffs area mid-afternoon.
We had some storms initially develop on the cold front that were kind of on their own. These were mainly producing some large hail, and one of them likely produced a brief tornado near Little Sioux, Iowa. We still need to send out a survey team to confirm everything, but we do believe there is at least one tornado up that way.
Further to the south, storms developed in southeast Nebraska, touching off a possible tornado near Tecumseh and generating numerous hail reports.
As storms got more into the Iowa area, they began to kind of congeal into a larger line. So as that kind of occurred, the hail started to decrease in size but be more plentiful. So we were getting a lot of reports of smaller hail but significant amounts of it and a little bit of strong wind, but not too many reports severe hail, but there was here and there.
That same line of storms entered southwest Iowa later in the afternoon. Fremont County Emergency Management Coordinator Clayton Long says at least two tornadoes developed in his county.
Roughly after 5 p.m., we had our first tornado warning for the county. It was tracking southwest from Nebraska and Missouri. And through a preliminary investigation here, reports coming in, sounds like we had about two tornadoes that touched down east of Riverton, south of Farragut. These impacted agriculture lands. There were two debris clouds that were shown. Still trying to work through the pictures and the videos coming in to analyze, but there was no damages or injuries with this.
Long says it's fortunate the twisters missed populated areas of the county.
Yeah, this is a best case scenario by all aspects, especially after last April 17th, where we had a lot of property damage. For right now, at least knock on wood here, have not heard any sort of property damages or injuries, mainly touchdown in agriculture fields, right ahead or during planting season. So there wasn't a crop impact either. So really, this was just best case scenario.
Sirens sounded across Page County as the storms entering from Fremont County touched off tornado warnings in both northern and southern portions of the county. Page County Emergency Management Coordinator Jill Harvey says early indications were that the county escaped significant damage from the storm activity.
I know we had several reports of rotation, a couple possibly debris fields, which I would think maybe, it got close enough to the ground to pull some of the dirt and stuff up. We did have a possibility of that with the second round that came through down between, just west of College Springs. There was some reports there, and I think the only damage I had reported to me was a tree that was across the road, and that was cleaned up, I think, by the property owner.
Harvey says the county storm spotters pinpointed area's rotation.
I think it was southwest of the hospital over in Shenandoah, and we had some by the Clarinda Airport and then out in the Hepburn area. Those were spots that the Weather Service had noted on radar, and so we had spotters out looking for them, but nothing came out of it.
Likewise, Harvey says the county received few, if any, reports of hail. She credits the National Weather Service for warning of Thursday's severe weather potential earlier in the week.
Obviously, it can change. I mean, it was changing yesterday morning as to where, it was anticipated coming through, where that front was. I just think it's a good idea if it's out there so people have an idea, and can start pre-planning. Hey, what do I have going on? Yes, sometimes it doesn't happen, but I would rather you be aware and watching for what's coming and just taking that extra minute to make sure, do I have my alerts on? Do I know how to find reliable information if I'm not in my normal space?
As similar warnings were issued in Montgomery, Adams, Union, and Decatur counties in southwest and south central Iowa, and in Atchison and Nottoway counties in northwest Missouri. No damage was reported from those warnings. Following a quiet day today, Weather Service officials say severe weather is possible again tomorrow afternoon and evening into the overnight hours. Don't say you weren't warned. Nine candidates vying for five spots on the Page County Board of Supervisors were together in one location Tuesday night. Members of the newly formed Southwest Iowa Republican Women's Group staged a supervisors' candidates forum at the county courthouse's Page Room in Clarinda. During the hour-long forum, the candidates were asked to name the challenges the county is facing. Participants included the three candidates running for the 4th District Supervisors Republican nomination in the June Iowa primary, incumbent Judy Clark and challengers Jamie Shore and Dennis Boger. Clark says Page and other counties are facing the same challenges.
Among them are one-size-fits-all policies that don't account for differences in county size, limitations on property evaluations, ongoing debates about property tax relief, and unfunded mandates that require counties to provide services without sufficient funding. Additional concerns include budget constraints, eminent domain issues, changes in township administration, Iowa code requirements, and large-scale energy projects such as carbon pipelines, solar developments, and wind turbines.
Shore named taxes and infrastructure as two challenges facing the county. Currently a Clarinda City Council member, Shore says the council has worked to reduce property taxes during his tenure.
The tax levy rate that we have today is lower than what it was 12 years ago. So that's something that I'm proud to point out. We worked really hard to keep taxes as low as possible. Obviously, people aren't feeling that because your assessed values are 25% to 35% higher. But what we have control of, we have done our due diligence and tried to keep everything as low as possible.
Candidates were also asked about how they would make decisions as a supervisor. Boger says he would research each issue.
Study it up, get the correct answers, get the facts, then go to the people, talk to the people, see what their feelings are, how they feel about the different things, bring all the information to the board and discuss it and come up with a solution.
County Attorney Jim Varley served as moderator for the hour-long event. Varley's last question dealt with time commitment and responsibility. Candidates were asked how much time they would commit to the demands of being a supervisor. Seth Stimson and Jeff Brownfield are running for the District 3 Supervisors GOP nomination. Based on his life experiences, Stimson says he has no problem with time management.
Time and task management is my bread and butter, honestly. There's been times in my life where I was a branch manager. I had 15 people that reported to me, another 90 people. A lot of responsibilities. We were planting a church, which if you've ever even known what that's like, there's lots and lots of time. Five children, some coaching, remodeling some homes. So yeah, time and task management is something I'm kind of is built within me.
Currently the mayor of Blanchard and a past or present member of various boards, Brownfield says areas like budget preparation take extra time.
And in budget time, it's busy. You need to know what we're going to put all our money into and how much we're going up and what the county's given for raises and all of that, and that all factors into it. I know that, like, landfill, it's easy. That landfill is something that makes money. Page County Landfill does make money, and they don't take any taxpayer.
Former Supervisor Alan Armstrong and Mike Anderson vie for the 1st District Supervisor seat. Armstrong says he spent as much time as needed during his previous supervisor stint. He adds an experienced team of county officials and employees make the job easier.
We are blessed in this county with some excellent employees, and whether they were elected or hired, they're all here for the same purpose. They want to do the best for Page County. And when you have a knowledge base that is as deep as we have in Page County, it makes our job a lot easier.
Anderson says he'll spend whatever time is necessary to help the county citizens.
I understand it's time consuming. If you want to get a job done right, it's going to take time to get it done and to basically do your investigation to make sure you're doing it right.
Two incumbents unchallenged in the June primary, District 3 Supervisor Todd Maher and District 5 Supervisor Brian Rogers, also participated in the forum. Controversy over the handling of an investigation into a 2023 structure fire took center stage at a special Tabor City Council meeting Wednesday night. Local resident Andy Hansen aired allegations based on a series of records he requested regarding a structure fire at MJ Electronics located at 506 New Street in Tabor on March 3, 2023. Last month, reckless use of fire or explosive charges were filed against 42-year-old Jeremy Ramos, who recently began renting the business. He was also a volunteer firefighter, but the charge was ultimately dismissed after Tabor police officials said a clerical error caused the criminal complaint to be filed March 7th, after the statute of limitations had expired, rather than March 2nd. However, after reviewing the state fire marshal's report, obtaining Tabor Police Chief Derek Astrop's investigative report about the incident, and the Tabor Fire Department's report, Hansen said he had several concerns over how the investigation into the matter was handled and questioned whether the department had grounds to charge Ramos.
Two individuals observed near the fire at the time it began were never followed up with or asked to provide statements. A potential suspect identified by Mr. Ramos was not investigated. Information was requested multiple times by an assisting special investigator that may have assisted with the digital analysis of the security camera was never provided. The criminal complaint filed by Chief Astrop stated that Mr. Ramos was the only individual in the vicinity of the fire, which directly contradicts his statements in the investigative report, which names two other people who were in the area and persons of interest.
After a search warrant for Ramos's security cameras raised concerns that some footage may have been deleted, Hansen says the camera's hard drive was submitted to Special Deputy Anthony Cava of the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office, whose case report was also provided through a public information request. Based on that report, Hansen says several requests from Cava went unanswered from Tabor Police, including a request for the investigative report in 2023, and no additional discussions occurred in 2025 after Cava, in April of that year, indicated he advised Astrop that additional information could be recovered from the camera hard drive with newer software.
According to Investigator Cava, he had access to newer software and advised Chief Astrop that the statute of limitations for the case was nearing, and he wanted to try again to obtain the camera footage. Chief Astrop replied that he was out of the office and would send it when I get back. According to the unit daily activity log provided by the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, Chief Astrop went on duty at 11:04 a.m. that day and ended his shift at 6:06 a.m. the following day. Cava's report ends with, I did not receive any additional information.
Hansen also raised concerns over what he felt were inappropriate comments made by Fremont County Sheriff Kevin Astrop at the council's meeting March 12, 2025, after Mayor Devin Jewell outlined expectations for the department, including accurate documentation of work hours and calls for service.
To be clear, the Tabor Police Department reports to the mayor and the city council, not the Fremont County Sheriff's Office. Maintaining that distinction is essential, especially in the current setup, with the county sheriff being the father of the city police chief in this county. Any external influence, particularly where personal relationships exist, raises legitimate concerns about conflicts of interest and should be addressed with transparency and adherence to established policy.
Hansen also emphasized that citizens should have a right to request public information without fear of intimidation or retaliation. Since making his public record request, Hansen alleges he had received a phone call from Kevin Astrop, which led to a formal complaint being filed against the Fremont County Board of Supervisors, and that his employer had been contacted multiple times by both Kevin Astrop and Derek Astrop. Jewell told KMA News the issues raised by Hansen were concerning and that the city would need to look into them further. Red Oak officials are asking for Montgomery County's assistance in settling a dispute over emergency medical services. Discussion over the City of Red Oak's cost-share request to five other communities for ambulance operations took place at Tuesday morning's Montgomery County Board of Supervisors meeting. Saying the county's EMS is at a decision point, Red Oak City Administrator Lisa Cotter outlined why the city is asking Stanton, Elliott, Villisca, Grant, and Emerson to contribute to the city's ambulance services.
We have asked the five communities to collectively contribute $110,000. The individual requests come from $2,000 in the case of Grant, to $46,000 in the case of Villisca, and those charges are based on size or call volume from last year. Another way to think about the basis of our request is like insurance. It's like an insurance contribution, a way to ensure that the system that is currently staffed, equipped, and ready to respond when someone calls even though you don't know when that call is needed.
Of the 1,350 calls handled by Red Oak Ambulance last year, Cotter says 15% were in the five communities. She claims Red Oak is the only city providing a regular and planned funding source for a service that is being used across all communities.
If you think about it from a business perspective, imagine one business that builds its business and maintains a 24/7, 365 coverage, and that system has a fixed cost to be operational and be ready to be used. If there were other small businesses around that business that needed to rely on that system, but they didn't know when the need would arise, the question would become, is that first business who's operating a full-time system, would they provide free service to the smaller businesses around them?
While saying the city has made a good faith effort to communicate with each community, Cotter says engagement has been limited and no formal agreements are in place. Without a 28E agreement, Cotter says Red Oak is not obligated to provide ambulance coverage to the other towns under state law.
As we approach a new fiscal year on July 1, Red Oak has decisions to make. Without agreements in place, the city's intent is to begin invoicing each city on a per-call basis, per-hour basis on July 1. And if those invoices go unpaid, then we will look at giving final notice that without reimbursement, there is the possibility that we no longer will provide free service.
Cotter called on the supervisors to become active in the conversation and encourage the communities to reach a reasonable agreement with Red Oak. She also called on the board to facilitate discussions regarding an EMS essential services referendum for a future election. Supervisor Alex Burton, however, criticized the approach Red Oak has taken on the issue.
You've been abrasive, to say the least, in your initial connections with these communities and with these leaders. You've threatened to not show up. You've made statements like, these communities are getting a service for free, and that's categorically not true. So as you go through that, unfortunately, I think what's led us here today has been your approach. And with a different approach, you might have more cooperation from these communities.
Burton called on Red Oak to step back from its payment demands in order for any essential services referendum to succeed, saying the thought of not providing service to someone in need makes him ill. Supervisor Mike Olson says the ambulance funding issue must be settled.
And I know the city of Red Oak needs funding, just like everybody. But we have to keep in mind that we have an obligation to our constituents. And one of those is to not let them lay somewhere waiting for a squad from Atlantic to show up and them die.
More discussion is expected at a future supervisors meeting. Shenandoah Public Library is hoping for some cool projects this summer thanks to a new sunshade. Ribbon-cutting ceremonies for the library's amphitheater sunshade project were held at a Shenandoah Chamber and Industry Association coffee Wednesday morning. Construction on the shade covering the library's outdoor amphitheater began in September 2024 and wrapped up in October 2025. Library officials say the sunshade will allow for outdoor amphitheater activities during the summer. Shenandoah Library Director Carrie Falk thanked a long list of groups and individuals making the project possible, including the library's foundation, which raised approximately $300,000 in donations.
If we had not had people generously giving to the library foundation, we would not have been able to pay for this. So I want you to know, no city funds were used. This is all donations through the library foundation.
A plaque honoring donors is placed at the sunshade's base. Falk also thanked the library's sunshade committee, which first met back in 2018, plus the city of Shenandoah and the Frank's Design Group of Glenwood for the project's design. Ethan Miller is an architect with Frank's. Miller says the shade's design is based on tree colors.
There is approximately five different colors in this entire structure, not counting the superstructure itself, but the plates are comprised of five different colors. And the way we organized them was we went from a darker brown at the center point, and then we kind of radiated out to a green there.
Among other things, architect Pete Frank says the sunshade is a unique design that in many respects symbolizes the pages of a library book.
What we really love about this project is between the colors and interacting with the sun and the environment. This thing is, you know, quite literally, it's never the same thing at any given moment, which is also, I think, a really appropriate analogy. I'm going to really throw a bone here to what a public library is about. that a public library is a living, breathing, evolving entity, and your grandma's library is not the same as this library.
Franks designed the library's expansion and renovation project, which was completed in 2012. Iowa's top economic development official gave her thumbs up on activities and projects in Shenandoah this week. Debbie Durham serves as director of the Iowa Economic Development Authority and the Iowa Finance Authority. Durham, along with IEDA business specialist Jim Thompson, toured the community Wednesday to check out projects previously receiving grants from the Iowa Community Catalyst Program and projects in line for possible funding from the Charles E. Lakin Foundation's Revitalize Southwest Iowa Initiative. Durham told KMA News she was impressed by two of the facilities included in the tour.
Well, first of all, we got to go to the mill because we gave that a Catalyst grant years ago, and then to see the upper floors and what the big plans are for, you know, the commercial kitchen and possibly housing on the very top floor. That was incredible. We went to see your medical complex, your hospital, the new cancer center. I have to tell you, as a 8-year, God willing, cancer survivor, I mean, it is an incredible place to receive treatment where people can stay right here and don't have to go to places like Omaha to do that.
She also received an update on plans for the Wabash Trace Nature Trail, a former Destination Grant recipient, and the proposed Shenandoah Fieldhouse Project, a possible Vision Shenandoah funding recipient. Durham says Shenandoah's unified effort on several fronts is a plus.
I like it that you're all pulling in the same direction, right? It seems like, you know, really engaged mayor, great city administrator, you know, your main streets, your economic development groups in the area, and the businesses. I mean, it just seems... So we met from everything from private citizens to those in elected officials, and I think it's the thing that you have a plan.
Durham says Community Catalyst Awards are expected to be announced this fall. April is Donate Life Month, and the story of a young Iowan is helping inspire people to become organ donors. Over 2 years ago, Liz Markert, a volunteer with the Iowa Donor Network and a Manson, Iowa resident, set off on the Drive for Life Emily's Legacy DMV tour, raising awareness and spreading resources about organ and tissue donation. The tour is also in honor of Markert's daughter Emily, who received life-saving lung transplants from her uncles, Don and Larry Fitzgerald, and had 15 years added to her life before passing away in 2014 after a battle with cancer. During a stop at the Page County Courthouse in Clarinda Tuesday afternoon, Markert told KMA News visits are a chance to tell her daughter's story, share resources, and dispel misconceptions about organ donations.
It's been quite an experience these last 2.5 years that I've been doing this. I've met total strangers that we share stories, and it's all because of the impact of organ donation that has allowed another person to live their life fully.
Markert says her daughter Emily first fell ill with a form of pneumonia in 1999 at just 17 years old. It was taken to St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester, Minnesota, where the condition of her lungs deteriorated rapidly. At that time, Markert says lung transplants were rare. The long wait time to receive the life-saving measure and a shortage of donations led the family to California, where Emily was able to receive the living-related lobar lung transplant, a still relatively new procedure at the time.
Two of my brothers each gave her a lobe of their lung. So they removed Emily's lung, and my brother Don donated a lobe from his right side, and my brother Larry donated a lobe from his left side. And both of those lobes expanded. And Emily was petite, and my brothers were 6'3", and they completely filled her cavity. It was amazing.
More than 5 years after her initial transplant, Markert says her daughter's lungs began to fail again before she got a double lung transplant from a donor who passed away. Markert says the current tour is one of the ways she kept a promise made to her daughter shortly before her passing to continue spreading the awareness about the importance of organ, eye, and tissue donation.
For the first few years after Emily passed, I held a 5K walk and run, and she was a runner, so we honored her in that way. We had several community members and from surrounding members come, and we did that for 10 years, and after 10 years, I decided I needed to take another journey for Emily and create awareness, and that's what I'm doing now.
And Markert has already visited over 60 counties in Iowa on her tour. That wraps up this week in KMA Land. Be listening each week at this time for This Week in KMA Land. And for more information all the time, log on to KMALand.com, where you can also hear this program in its entirety. For the entire KMA News team, this is Mike Peterson. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. This Week in KMA Land, a presentation of KMA News, keeping the region informed for 100 years.